From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on tensions in Iraq. A mix of sadness and anger after a strike in eastern Ukraine. Agreement to prevent forced labor, plus sending a positive message to immigrants. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A top government official says Iraqi forces have regained initiative in their fight against Sunni militants who seize large parts of the country and vow to overrun Baghdad. Not all circles agree, as we hear now from reporter Edward Uranian and the VOA Middle East Bureau.
I witness reports and information on rival television networks are contradictory. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri Maliki lashed out at media organizations Friday for allegedly distorting the truth. The government cut internet connections Sunday in another sign of nervousness. Iraqi intelligence chief General Qasem Mohammed Atta said Sunday the situation in the capital Baghdad was secure and government forces were pushing back the militants from the al-Qaeda-linked Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. He says that the situation differs from that of 1 or 2 days ago, and the government armed forces have gained traction. He says the situation in Baghdad is completely under control, and security checkpoints are in place in various areas to defend against attack. Eyewitness reports say cement roadblocks have been erected in front of key government installations, including the governmental nerve center in Baghdad's Green Zone. Volunteers were reported to be digging trenches in the north of the capital. Arab TV channels reported a car bomb killed more than a dozen people in the center of Baghdad. Heavy fighting and government air raids were also reported over the town of Tal Afar near Mosul, and General Atta said Iraqi forces pushed back ISIL militants near the town of Balad, north of Baghdad. Al Arabiya TV reported government planes bombed a Kurdish Peshmerga convoy near the oil-rich city of Kirkuk, now under Kurdish control. The report said more than a dozen Peshmerga fighters were killed or wounded. Other reports indicated the Peshmerga had captured the Yarubiya border post between Iraq and Syria on the road to Mosul.
كثير ممن يحملون السلاح في داخل مدينة الموصل هم ليسوا إرهابيين.
The governor of Mosul, Athil Nujafi, complained that government warplanes were bombing civilian targets inside the city, now occupied by Sunni militants. He went on to argue the forces controlling the city belong to different Sunni factions and not just to ISIL. A Sharqiya TV showed long lines of hundreds of vehicles, which it claimed continue to flee Mosul. Sunni militants also reportedly blew up 2 churches inside the city, and many, if not all, remaining Christian residents of the city have reportedly fled. While thousands of Shiite volunteers turned out in government-held areas to join the Iraqi military, some reports say many Sunnis were reportedly joining the militants and their allies. In Cairo, Arab League deputy head Ahmed Ben Heli told a news conference the group's ministerial council is supporting the Iraqi government's effort to defeat the terrorists.
أيضا أكد المجلس دعم العراق في مواجهة الأعمال الإرهابية.
But he urged the country's fractious leaders to overcome their political and religious differences and to form a united government. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
For some perspective on the state of al-Qaeda and its affiliates, VOA's Carol Castiel and Hentik Fenty spoke with Catherine Zimmerman, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Here's Carol Castiel.
Catherine, I'd like to get your take on the status of al-Qaeda as you see it today. If you agree with President Obama that al-Qaeda core or the al-Qaeda central, as we know it, has been severely degraded, and that what is of more concern are its affiliates around the world.
Obama's message that Al-Qaeda Central has been degraded rings true, but the problem is that he's presenting the rest of Al-Qaeda as decentralized and weaker. The fact is, during the Arab Spring, over the course of 2011, all of these affiliates in Yemen, in Somalia, in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere developed relationships that actually extend across the Muslim-majority world, and it's these relationships that have made the network itself stronger. They're much more resilient in terms of attacks, and they share resources like expertise, building bombs, foreign fighters, money. All of this can be utilized in an attack against the United States or our interests in the region, as we've seen. And this is one of the reasons why I am very concerned about the dismissal of the threat from Al-Qaeda. It's still very strong today. And just because we've hammered it in Afghanistan and Pakistan doesn't mean that the threat has disappeared.
Well, to his credit, or to be fair to President Obama, he did say that the threat is still significant, but it requires a sort of a shift in our strategy, and he wants to partner with other countries, I guess, like in Mali, the French, in Yemen, the Yemeni security forces. What about this shift to work with our partners? Do you think that will be effective?
I'm very hesitant in saying that it will be. It's actually not a shift in strategy because we've been partnering with the Yemeni military, the African Union peacekeeping forces in Somalia, the Mali army and other African forces in Mali. That hasn't pushed the groups back. What is new is the dedication of a budget, essentially, for this counterterrorism force. And Obama has twisted it in some degree and presented the entire strategy as being new. When you look at the efficacy of our partners, it's very mixed. And in some cases, like in Nigeria, it's been counterproductive.
Counterproductive in Nigeria?
What has happened over the past 3 years is that the terrorist group Boko Haram has actually moved from being a smaller terrorist group and simply a nuisance to an active insurgency. And the threat it poses today to the Nigerian state and its reach, Boko Haram's reach, is much greater than it was 3 years ago because of the activities pursued by the Nigerian military.
Indeed. Well, that's a very good point, which we want to pursue in a bit. But let me let Henok Fente ask a question first.
Now, let me ask you, Catherine. The president crystallized the new strategy. And, of course, this strategy has been being implemented in Africa for a number of years. The United States partners with the government of Somalia, the African Union forces, as you mentioned earlier, as well as with the government of Nigeria. This begs the question, without putting boots on the ground, I'm talking about U.S. military on the ground, this kind of partnerships in the short term and then the long-term effectiveness of this kind of strategies, if you could talk about that, because in the short term, yes, there needs to be security cooperations, but in the long term also, making sure that these countries are stable, that the governance thrives in these countries is an issue.
I think that's a very fair point where a lot of our counterterrorism strategy today is looking at the short-term effect. We use drone strikes to interdict and disrupt ongoing plots, and we rely on our partners in various countries to actually try to roll back the territorial gains. But what we haven't done is undertaken a strategy that actually looks at the long term, the governance issues in many of these areas, and the grievances that actually are driving the conflict. And it's these grievances that allow Al-Qaeda groups to gain popular support and actually exploit populations to their advantage. So that's where I think that this counterterrorism strategy actually falls a little bit short, where we're relying simply on military partners to produce a military defeat against a terrorist group. In many of these cases, it's not terrorism, it's an insurgency. That's an entirely different effort from the United States, and it's one that I'm not seeing.
Catherine Zimmerman, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. She was speaking with VOA's Carol Castiel, host of the program, Press Conference USA, and Henok Fente of the VOA Horn of Africa service. You can hear their entire conversation by going to our website, voanews.com, and look for Press Conference USA under the Programs tab.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Israeli troops on Sunday arrested some 80 Palestinians, including dozens of members of Hamas, in a raid in the West Bank as the prime minister accused the Islamic militant group of kidnapping three teenagers who went missing nearly 3 days ago. Benjamin Netanyahu has condemned Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's agreement with Hamas and said that he would hold him responsible for the safety of the youths who disappeared apparently while hitchhiking in the West Bank late Thursday.
You remember that Israel warned the international community about the dangers of endorsing the Fatah-Hamas unity pact. I believe that the dangers of that pact should now be abundantly clear to all. We've seen since the signing of that pact an increase in terrorist activity emanating from the West Bank.
Mr. Netanyahu did not say how Israel determined Hamas was responsible for the kidnappings. Palestinian self-rule government, which administers 38% of the West Bank, has insisted it's not to blame, saying the teens went missing in territory under full Israeli control. Ehab Bisesio is a spokesperson for the new Palestinian unity government, which includes Hamas-ruled Gaza and Fatah.
The disappearance of the three settlers is not a result of the new formed government. In reality, we condemn all the escalation that has been taken by the Israeli government and by the Israeli army for the last 2 days as a collective punishment against our people besieging the province of Hebron.
Despite the exchange of accusations, security officials from Israel and from the Palestinian forces have been cooperating closely in the West Bank trying to find the kidnappers. Also in the news, Ukraine's foreign minister has described Russian President Vladimir Putin in vulgar terms as protesters in Kiev attacked the Russian embassy to protest the downing of a cargo plane that killed 49 people. Angry protesters ripped up a Russian flag, hurled rocks and eggs at the embassy, and overturned luxury cars on Saturday night. Acting Ukrainian Foreign Minister Andrei Desetsia urged them to stop, but cited the crowd with his description of Mr. Putin. The comment drew a rebuke from Moscow on Sunday, which urged Ukraine to fire its top diplomat. Protests came as Ukraine's new president, Petro Poroshenko, declared Sunday a national day of mourning. And that national day of mourning came after the deaths of those servicemen killed when pro-Russian separatists shot down that military plane over the volatile east. VOA's Anita Powell reporting now from Kiev. The latest events sent residents into the churches in the capital and drew angry crowds to Kiev's Independence Square.
Two strong emotions have washed over Ukraine's capital, sorrow and anger. At midday Sunday, the nation observed a minute of silence in mourning for 49 soldiers who were killed Saturday when pro-Russian fighters shot down a Ukrainian military transport plane. Throngs of worshippers prayed earnestly at a church in central Kiev that offered refuge and medical facilities to protesters during protests earlier this year that unseated the pro-Russian president. Outside, a blue-eyed young soldier who gave his name only as Private Nikolai said he empathized with the families who lost their loved ones. He says as a soldier, he knows what it is like when a mother loses her son, what commanders and others feel protecting their country, their Ukraine, their children. He says soldiers are carrying out the oath they gave to protect the interests of Ukraine and are fulfilling their duty. A grandmother from northern Ukraine, Zinaida, said she spent more than a decade living in Russia. She says even now, during war, Ukrainians do not hate the Russian people and have no desire to kill. She says the leaders of the two countries are responsible for lots of things. She added that she cannot understand why the two countries, with so much in common, are fighting, and urges reconciliation. But others expressed darker emotions. On Saturday, 300 protesters crowded the Russian embassy in Kiev, hurling epithets at Russia. The former Soviet nations are struggling to hold peace talks after pro-Russian separatists began a military campaign in the Russian-speaking east. The two nations are also on the brink of a breakdown in talks over Russia's role in supplying natural gas to Ukraine, which Moscow has threatened to cut off as soon as Monday. On the streets of Kiev, retired geologist Vasily Mikhailovich had no kind words for the Russian leader.
Я ненавижу Путина. Ненавижу чем только это вообще это урод, это не человек.
He says he hates Russian President Vladimir Putin and calls him an inhuman monster. He calls the situation a nightmare and a disaster that means some kind of doom on Ukraine. Words like that appear to have become increasingly common in the cosmopolitan Ukrainian capital, filled with Baroque architecture and chic sidewalk cafes, yet where Russian is the most common spoken language. Kievites say they applaud new President Petro Poroshenko's goal to join his nation with the European Union. But Poroshenko has more urgent matters before him with the ongoing violence. In Kiev's independent square, the Maidan, hardcore Ukrainian nationalists in dirty, mismatched camouflage stood next to striking, fashion-conscious women. Together, they yelled phrases like, "Glory to Ukraine." At the rain-soaked protests, leaders urged Ukrainians to fight for their sovereignty. This protest leader says they want an independent Ukraine, a sovereign, democratic country. A nearby blue and yellow flag fluttered at half-staff, contributing to the mix of grief and defiance. As Russia and Ukraine face off, the question is, which emotion is going to win? Anita Powell, VOA News, Kyiv.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
New global treaty to tackle modern forms of forced labor has been overwhelmingly approved by 177 member states attending the annual International Labor Conference. Only 8 countries voted against. The treaty spells out ways to prevent, protect, and compensate victims of forced labor. Lisa Schlein reports from ILO headquarters in Geneva.
The International Labor Organization estimates 21 million men, women, and children around the world are in forced labor, an illegal enterprise that generates about $150 billion a year. The ILO adopted 2 conventions on forced labor in 1930 and 1957. The new protocol brings these 2 outdated conventions into the 21st century. International Labor Committee on Forced Labor President David Garner says the treaty focuses on contemporary forms of slavery. It tackles practices such as human trafficking.
I think the key aspects are that it calls on member states to give effect to their obligation to suppress forced labor, as enshrined in Convention 29, by strengthening in particular prevention and protection measures, by enabling victims to access remedies such as compensation and to sanction the perpetrators of forced or compulsory labour. There was also consensus within the committee that the punishment of offenders is important, but it is also equally important to ensure that the rights of victims are protected.
The ILO says victims of forced labour often are treated like criminals instead of people in need of assistance. The head of the ILO's Special Action Program on Forced Labor, Beate Andries, says the new protocol remedies this injustice.
There's one important provision now in the protocol to protect victims from being punished for criminal activities they may have been forced to carry out while they were in forced labor. Some victims, for instance, are forced to plant drugs or to traffic drugs.
The ILO estimates 55% of forced labor victims are female, 45% are male, and 26% are children. Victims may be in bonded labor or working under slave-like conditions in a wide range of industries. The ILO says women and girls are primarily forced into domestic work and commercial sexual exploitation, while men and boys are in forced economic exploitation in agriculture, construction, and mining. It says many work long hours, often for little or no pay. Two states must ratify the protocol for it to go into force, and individual governments must ratify the new protocol to become legally bound by its provisions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
With more than 4 million first-generation immigrants living within New York State borders, government officials, immigrant advocates, and community members often attend conferences that address their many complex legal, political, and humanitarian concerns. But until now, there has been little coordination or constructive conversation among those stakeholders. VOA's Adam Phillips attended a conference designed to change all of that.
It was lunchtime in a packed Manhattan meeting hall, and a conference called This Land Is Your Land Too had been busily underway for hours. Cesar Perales, New York Secretary of State, was heartened to see the diversity within the gathering.
I think the importance of today is that we are seeing representatives of the community-based agencies, not-for-profit groups who work with immigrants, coming down, sitting with government officials, both at the New York City, New York State, and even the federal government level, learning about each other, wanting to work with one another to ensure that the system works well.
It's easy to understand why immigrants wish to be welcomed. And Perales says that New York State has an economic interest in welcoming them.
From a very selfish perspective, these newcomers are very, very important to our economy. They provide labor, they start businesses, and so we want to make sure that immigrants will stay in New York, understand that they are wanted in New York.
Nisha Agarwal, New York State's Commissioner for Immigrant Affairs, would like to make it easier for immigrants to stay. She supports immigration reform that helps undocumented immigrants gain legitimacy and eases the path to citizenship.
People's lives are transformed. They can be pulled out of poverty and stay out of poverty if they have appropriate legal status.
Agarwal says the rules currently in place are a bureaucratic and humanitarian disaster.
Breadwinners being deported and permanently removed from their family, kids entering the foster care system because of that, and just people living in fear because they don't have appropriate immigration status. That's not in anybody's interest.
She says that city-sponsored focus groups recently established that 1 out of 4 young immigrants were technically eligible for legal relief but didn't know it.
They've been living undocumented, and they don't have to be, and I think that's astounding.
Attorney Camille Mackler of the New York Immigration Coalition says that getting accurate legal information to both rural and urban immigrants can be challenging, but for different reasons.
In New York City, we face communities that are a lot more insular, a lot more closed in on themselves, where we're having a hard time getting the trust of the communities to have them to come out and meet with representatives outside of their communities to get help. Upstate, the problem is that they're spread out. They're a lot more widespread, and they're also not participating in any sort of civic life. They're not part of the towns. They purposely stay outside of the towns. They fear profiling, they fear discrimination, and they fear law enforcement.
Getting adequate legal representation can be especially difficult for rural immigrants. Many work on farms and cannot make a daytime appointment with a lawyer. Without documentation, they cannot get driver's licenses. This can put city-based lawyers out of reach as well. To help, the New York Immigration Coalition runs a government-funded program to train local grassroots advocates who are not attorneys. Other groups help make it easier for immigrants to get to English classes, to connect with skills and job training opportunities, and to obtain practical support for starting a business. All efforts to let immigrants know that this land is their land, too. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And the city where Pele rose to fame honored its favorite son on Sunday, celebrating his life, his career as Brazil's football great. As that country hosts the World Cup, hundreds of dignitaries on hand in the port city of Santos to toast the 73-year-old Pele at the official opening of the Pele Museum. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington, and we want you to have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On June 16, 1816, the famous English poet Lord Byron is believed to have read the book Phantasmagoriana to four house guests in Switzerland. The reading led him to challenge his guests, Percy Shelley, Mary Shelley, Claire Claremont, and John Polidori, to write their own ghost stories. As a result, Mary Shelley wrote the novel Frankenstein, John Polidori wrote a short story called The Vampire, and Byron wrote the poem Darkness, all horror classics. In 1858, Abraham Lincoln accepted the Illinois Republican Party's nomination for a seat in the U.S. Senate, warning that tensions over the issue of slavery threatened to split the nation. That split did, in fact, occur 2 years later when Lincoln, having lost his bid to become a senator, was elected president of the United States. Pro-slavery states immediately began to leave the Union, and soon the nation was in a full-blown civil war. In 1903, the Ford Motor Company, founded by U.S. industrialist Henry Ford, was incorporated. In 1940, Marshal Henri-Philippe Pétain became the prime minister of the Vichy government of Nazi-occupied France during World War II. Pétain was convicted of treason after the war. His death sentence was commuted to life in prison. In 1947, Dumont broadcast the first television network newscast. It was called News from Washington. In 1958, former Hungarian premier Imre Nagy was executed for treason by his country's communist authorities. A proponent of liberal reforms, Nagy became a symbol of resistance to Soviet interference in Hungarian affairs. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Promoting democracy worldwide remains a key U.S. priority, not only because democracy promotes fundamental values such as respect for human rights, but also because democratic governments promote more stable, inclusive societies and create the best conditions for prosperity. In democratic societies, voters hold governments accountable for their well-being. As a result, genuinely democratic governments encourage participation from all sectors of society, enable the formation of capable, reliable, and transparent institutions, ensure the rule of law, independent judiciaries, free presses, and strong civil society and private sectors. These institutions, in turn, protect democracy from those who might seek to weaken or trample upon it and create the conditions for broad-based economic growth and development. And this is largely what we've observed in most of the Western Hemisphere since the turn of the millennium. The last decade has been a story of democracy and economic achievement in Latin America and the Caribbean, writes Secretary of State John Kerry in a recent opinion column. This transformation didn't happen overnight, and it didn't happen by accident. Rising prosperity was produced by sustained efforts to open and integrate markets, encourage innovation, and recognize that a society achieves real prosperity and economic stability by embracing inclusiveness. As a result, the region's economies grew at a rate of 4% a year and lifted more than 73 million people out of poverty. Nonetheless, the job is not finished yet, wrote Secretary Kerry. The path we need to follow is crystal clear. Leaders across the hemisphere need to set aside racial differences in favor of inclusiveness, advocate for the rights of women, and recognize that sexual orientation is a private matter. They must build on economic progress by opening markets to free trade and expanding opportunities for young people eager to enter the workforce. The United States offers its support to regional initiatives like the Inter-American Social Protection Network to promote best practices on social protection through direct investment, such as our multi-year program with Colombia to improve access to justice and combat human rights violations in areas recovering from conflict, and through programs like the 100,000 Strong in the Americas Student Exchange Initiative. Accountable, democratic governance is the surest way to expand social and economic opportunities and attain inclusive development. The United States is committed to working with our partners to achieve these goals.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.